This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith here with Kathy Sheppes.
Hi, everyone.
And our guest in the studio is the founder of Seek Collective, Carol Miltimore. Hi.
Hi.
Did I say your name right?
Yes.
Okay. Carol, tell us a little bit about your background and sure. How you came to start Seek Collective.
Yeah. So I went to Parsons School of Design, and then I stayed working in fashion for quite some time. I sort of experimented a little bit in between graduating and starting work in fashion, doing a pre-grad school program in architecture, studying textiles, some roof farming in Brooklyn and Queens. But in the end, I really came back to fashion because of my love of the textiles and how personal it is. And I've worked across the board in different, from a couture designer in Paris to kind of a mass market brand in America and everything in between. So running the gamut and how I've had experience as a designer before I then went to India to start Seek Collective. The idea when I began it was more of an experiment and an exploration for myself. I was stuck behind a computer screen working with major big factories on the other side of the world, and I felt so disconnected from the process. But I really loved the process, and I think it's a really interesting, there's so many interesting techniques that can be shared and make the clothes so much more beautiful than just a piece of clothing. So I got an artist residency in India, and so I traveled with a one-way ticket, and I did a residency for a month working on my art, and then spent the rest of the time there, a few months traveling around the country, meeting with different artisans from natural dyers to handloom weavers, block printers, etc. And that sort of began out of, so Seek Collective began out of that, and it was the idea of, can I create something that's modern and relevant in fashion today that is really transparent and incorporates working with communities and traditional crafts, but it's not the sort of kind of hippie paisley moo-moos necessarily, and that's how it all began.
Okay, so you studied the Harvard Graduate School of Design.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was incredible. I still just think so fondly of my time there, and I think when I did it, I really loved architecture, but I loved architecture theory more than anything else, so I got really into... My final project was supposed to be designing the interior of a building, and I ended up doing the interior of the building, the landscape design next to it, and the urban planning on the sidewalk next to it also, but also speaks to me being a bit of a overachiever, workaholic. But I found when I walked away from it and I started looking at grad schools to think about going to architecture for my master's, I felt the reality would be me doing CADs for skyscrapers or something like that, and it didn't feel as creative fulfilling for me. And I wanted to have something that was still, I think fashion still embodies that kind of three-dimensional quality, and but in a much more personal way. You're still living in it, whether it's a building or an article of clothing. But I like that you can touch and feel, and it's so personal and touching all the time and sort of showing your barrier between yourself and the world with clothing. So, but the program itself was incredible. It was amazing.
So for fashion, are you primarily a kind of digital designer? Do you work on the computer when you're creating the concepts for clothing mostly?
I work by hand doing, all my prints I paint by hand first. I usually fill up an entire notebook of paintings before I figure out which direction I'm going to go in the end. And I sketch all my sketches for clothing designs by hand still. I've done CADs for work before, but I still really like doing everything by hand.
So I guess the urban farming was indicative of you also wanting to do something with your hands or be just more creative.
And environmental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you then working with screen printers there to create your prints? Or
I'm doing block printing.
Oh, it's block printing.
Yeah, we've done one print screen printed, but everything else has been all hand block printed. And that screen print's coming out actually this fall. But everything else is hand block, always hand block printed. Because I think that in of itself kind of is an art. You know, they take what I've painted, they then carve it by hand, and they print it by hand. So I liked, and I love how hand block printing, there's a lot kind of live edges and nothing. If you look really closely, there's always going to be that little imperfection in a way, or just a little bit different every meter, and I think that's exciting.
So you can do continuous printing. Mm-hmm. It's just a little slightly irregular, is it?
Yeah, because the biggest the block can be is really about 8 by 8 inches. And then if you have something that's multiple colors, each color is its own block. So multiple blocks often, yeah.
That's interesting. So how is your Hindi?
Poor. I can say I don't speak very good Hindi so well, though, that when I say in India, people think that I am fluent and then start speaking to me very quickly in Hindi.
I went to India in 1998 or 9 to shoot a documentary for Herman Miller, the furniture company.
Yeah.
And I was amazed by the idea that English and Hindi are not the only languages of India.
No.
It's hundreds of languages. Mm-hmm. And it's not, like, there are so many people there that speak all those different languages, and they're so mixed together that
it's
amazing.
Kind of proper Hindi anymore.
How do they communicate? Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the Hindi I have learned and what I learn and speak is very proper Hindi, I suppose. And so when I say a lot of things, people laugh because it's almost as if you're saying really old school proper British English or something, I think. Because now it's so mixed. You know, they mix in kind of English words. And then our factory is a woman-owned factory, stitching in Bangalore. So that's in South India. And Hindi is not the predominant language there. And so when I first started working down in the South and I would start speaking Hindi to somebody, they just were not having it. They didn't really want to deal with that, nor some of them don't even speak it. So it only kind of helps me in the North.
What languages did you run into?
I should know all the names of them, and I couldn't tell you without completely betraying them, and I don't want to do that.
Understandable. So what's the connection between, I mean, you're in New York and India with this brand. So
yeah.
So what's the connection? What's the flow? What do you do in each of the two places?
In New York, it's designing. It's also, I do some sort of muslins sampling here a lot. That way I can be hands-on with fittings and getting the fit right for new styles. And otherwise, everything else is in India. I started in India because for me it felt like the heritage was so rich there as a culture and place of textiles. There's not many places you can go and say, oh, here is a community they've been block printing for over 400 years. And I think there's something so special about that.
So are you working with, let's say, factories for mm-hmm. fabrics and then communities for workmanship, like with
so
cottage?
The block printing gets done in Jaipur and all the printing's in that area. Some fabric I source directly from a handloom weaver group I work with. Some is power loomed. I source from that area. Otherwise, then the handloom woven fabric is coming from central India, from the state Madhya Pradesh. And then the natural dyeing is done more on the border of Goa and Maharashtra. And then the stitching is then done in Bangalore. So it sort of travels down the country to then end up. And I stayed all in India because I thought, well, if the fabric's coming from there and I can find a place to stitch that is fair trade and really clean and a beautiful, wonderful kind of conditions to work in, and then I might as well have it stitched there also.
So what are the fair trade organizations that support you through this or that helped you to initially navigate, or do you have people navigating with you each trip? Like, how does it work?
Well, one of the organizations I work with is called Sadhana in Udaipur, and they're a certified fair trade, and I started working with them at the very beginning. So working with them really helped me navigate that. A lot of it also was me showing up in person, because I don't necessarily think if someone's just certified as something, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true, I would say. I always felt like if I was going to be producing anything, I want to vouch for it personally. I want to say that I've been there, that I check in once a year personally, that I know the people, and then I also have people there that I trust that check in then regularly for me when I'm not there. Because that matters even more to me than just saying it has, because especially anywhere in the world, I think you can just pay a lot of money to get a certification. It doesn't mean that
right.
they're necessarily following the rules or.
It's your own blockchain.
Yeah.
C Collective Blockchain.
So where's the name come from?
The name came from, it started with just Seek. I wanted it to be one word only. I was inspired by other brands that had, it was one word and it felt positive and felt like it was bigger than me. And it came for me, I ended up with Seek because I think it speaks to my mentality in life. It's sort of this idea of always searching, but also even with the how I started the brand, I was always searching and seeking out a better way of doing things.
So it has nothing to do with the Sikhs in India?
No, but you know, no one in India ever asked, but everyone in America always asks, which I find really, really
amazing.
It's
different spelling, too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a little bit different pronunciation, but it's funny how that comes up here a lot, because in India, it doesn't even cross their mind, which you would think they would associate it more, but... then collective came from, well, I need a trademark issue. I had to have a second word in order to trademark Seek because someone else had on reserve the word just Seek from Japan, actually, for underwear. So I kind of went back to the
That must be the vending machines.
Yeah. And I thought a lot about it. And for me, the collective then came from speaking to the collective of people behind each garment that produce it, that it's not, I never wanted to name a brand that was named after me because I don't think it is just about me. It's so much more than that. It's about the people making it. And I always wanted to kind of speak to that in some regard.
So do you work with a team here in New York, or is it just you in New York and your teams in India?
I have a small team here. Okay. I have an assistant here who's amazing, Julia. And then I have a CFO who's helped me a lot grow the brand and think differently outside the box when he came on board. Because I think when you're just a designer and you don't always think about the business side of things, and that really helped. So it's really small. And we have a bunch of freelance people, from graphic designers to copywriter. And so it's a lot of kind of part-time freelance people that are involved.
How old is the business?
About 5 years.
Okay. So how are you bringing in new customers, and how are you keeping them?
That's been a big shift in the last year and a half, or just year, I would say. We last year decided to leave doing traditional wholesale. So I don't do any more trade shows, which felt very freeing. I feel like those are sort of purgatory to sit through, but a lot of tears.
Certainly not a confidence builder.
No, I think that really tests your like moral state, like just your emotional well-being. But so I have a lot of empathy for everyone still doing it. But, I think we wanted to move to a more direct-to-consumer, partly because I think the industry's changing. I think the way wholesale used to work and how buyers were buying has changed dramatically, and still is. And so we wanted to have it more on our terms. And we also wanted to connect with the consumer more. And it made sense because we have such a story to tell in how we're producing and who we are, to be able to go direct to the customer and have that relationship felt really important. So now I would say it's more, everything from just social media, which is all run by me, to we have a part-time freelance digital marketing person that we came on board this year, doing more events, trying to do more just thought out, kind of whether it's a trunk show or some block printing workshop or something along those lines.
Your prints are beautiful.
Thank you.
And I mean, the collection looks really... it just looks really fresh and pretty. And it's also like there's not too much, which I kind of like.
Oh, that's, you know, good. What I mean? Because I'm always trying not to do, I guess in my mind, I'm like, oh, is it too much? So I'm always wanting to make sure it's not too much.
Well, I kind of wonder, as we keep talking about, reduction of clothing in this universe, it's like, why aren't we just starting out, smaller and more focused?
Yeah.
Because you can still tell a good message, which you are.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about, I think people or brands need to just focus on their niche in a way, because you can't do everything and you can't answer everything to everyone. So we're never going to be a basics brand, for instance, but I can incorporate some basic pieces. But otherwise, I think it really is something I think about whenever I check into how I'm growing the business and where I am year to year is I always keep wanting to kind of almost have more reduce more, get more focused, not do too much. And I think it's easy to do too much in fashion as a brand too. As you grow, there's a lot of pressure to do more and more. So, you know, the only way to, you know, this kind of pressure that's put on you to, you have to do more in order to keep growing more. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think you can keep a tight point of view in collection, production, and what you're producing and still grow.
So do your customers ask you a lot of questions about how the clothing is made, or like, are they fascinated by the story? Or
I get that a lot when I'm in India. So when I'm in India, I try to do a lot of Instagram stories, just everywhere I'm at every day, just sharing day to day what's going on. And that's when I get a lot more feedback about the process. I think it's really exciting. Last October I traveled and I brought a good friend who's a filmmaker, and they filmed everything. And so we've produced these kind of mini videos, and each one's specific. So one's about block printing, one's about the stitching, et cetera. And I think that was me wanting to put it out, because I think sometimes just in stills it's hard, but wanting to show in video, it's order easier to grasp.
Yeah, they're great. I watched them.
Oh, thank you. But more, I guess the customers more ask, now it's just more about fit. They want to make sure that it's going to be the right fit before they buy it. I think those are most of our questions that we get. It's less about the process, but maybe it's because we put so much of it out there.
Right.
Yeah. I really try to be really as transparent as possible on the website, a lot about each stage, and even on social media, I try to, you know, share that when I can, and when I'm there, I always share it. And
so now, are you thinking about recycling any of your clothing or encouraging your customers to do that?
Yeah, we did one year, and I want to do this again, and then we just have to figure out the best way of doing it. But it's this dream I have of doing it, really making it a kind of thing that's around all the time and not just, say, once a year, was if people had sea clothing that maybe they had had and they were tired of it, that they could send it back and we would over dye it with natural dyes to another color, so then it gives it a new life. Later in September, when we do the event with Kaiuchi, we're gonna offer people can bring things that they're tired of and they can even block print over that, so that'll bring
that.
So I think that's a way. Those are some things I've been always kind of mulling over and wanting to make more of a regular thing rather than just sort of a specialty event, for instance.
That's great.
Just to clarify, block printing is where you've got some sort of stamp, and
you're
stamping it multiple times to make blocks as your print.
Just like when we were kids, and you either have the little stamps or even like those kind of potato stamps, but this time they're wood and a little bit bigger. But same idea, absolutely.
Does that process fascinate you?
I can't get enough. I just think it's mesmerizing. And when you're there, it's even more magical, because the people doing it are just so, they've been doing it for so long. So the rhythm of them doing it is fascinating. I could stay there all day just staring at them doing it. It's because they're so fast and so perfect. It's really incredible. And when I've tried it, it's really hurts your hand a little bit if you're not used to it. So that also is like, wow, these people are amazing that they can just do this all day. And they've built up the tolerance for it.
They've developed muscles that we don't know we have.
Yeah.
Just one more reminder that robots don't make your clothes.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that. What kinds of things do you have or types of things do you do that your customers can participate in?
Yeah, that's important to us. I think, you know, we tried doing the traditional just pop-up shop kind of thing, and that never felt right, or it didn't really resonate or felt even that successful. But what feels better for us, and what's always been, I guess, more better received by our customers, is doing things that are more kind of intimate and experiential. So whether we've done things in the past, we'll do it again in the future, but we rent out a suite in the Beekman Hotel for a night, and people can come and be in the suite and mingle and have cocktails and shop and meet people. And we've done things where you can come to a trunk show and there's a block, you can come block print a bandana or a tote bag, or you can hand block print something else that you bring from home. We've done things we've done things that are just purely workshops. We've done things that are a combination of shopping and block printing, or I think in the future we want to incorporate some natural dyeing, but or just going somewhere special. We did an event last year at the Brooklyn Grange rooftop farm.
Nice. It's
And that was magical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. In the Brooklyn Navy Yards, it was really amazing.
And it there's so much going on that a lot of people don't know about. But so, and are you also doing things outside of New York? And is that working?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, California as well. Okay. So I'm sort of segueing into being part-time living in California now, between New York and California. So, and we've always done events out in Cal. It's always been a good place for us as well. So we're doing some out there as well more.
So where do you see Seed Collective in like 10 years?
That's a good question. I guess I see it as I always wanted my business to grow in a really kind of slow, healthy way that feels sustainable, not only to the production, to me, to everyone involved. So I see it growing. I think there's always ways to improve. I want to improve even more how I'm producing. I think there's always things I would love to source things even further back to even where the cotton's being sourced or something that we're handling weaving. There's just so much I still want to do. And I think fashion's such a complex supply chain. I would want to get even more involved in it. I want to be able to get customers really excited about that, because I think it's a really overwhelming thing for people, especially with all the talk about sustainability and there's so much greenwashing. It's how do you educate people without making them feel bad or making them feel like they're back in school and it's boring? You know, how do you get them excited and engaged and it's fun and interesting? And I think that's how I really want that to be part of how I grow Seek going forward over the next decade. And
when you mentioned pop-up shops not working for you, you referred to them as traditional pop-up shops, which seems crazy to me because 10 years ago, we didn't have pop-up shops. You couldn't get a landlord to let you use a storefront for a month. It was just not possible.
That's true. I think I forget now.
I think we all do. It's just become a part of the fashion business culture to do a pop-up.
Well, exactly. Traditional was sticking a bunch of rolling racks in. Like, there was no ambiance. There was no atmosphere. Now
there was no brand experience.
Right.
Yes. And I think that's sort of what I mean by traditional, I suppose, and pop-up, in that you have a storefront space, whether it's there permanently or even just for a month. But, you know, it's just you come to just shop, and it's not as much of an experience that you get to do, you know, whether that's you go somewhere special and you get to experience that, or you get to then you can try your hand at some sort of block printing or what have you. I think there's I want there to always be more to it, because otherwise otherwise everyone's going to just sit at home and buy online.
Yeah. Now, speaking of buying online, I noticed on your website that you have an accessibility statement.
Yes.
What's that about?
That is to make the website more accessible to all people. So whether there's, you know, the font needs to be bigger, or it allows it to be more accessible to people across the board. And I think it's important for that.
Mostly for visually impaired people.
Yeah.
People who are partially blind or completely blind, the website can be read to them by the computer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So was there a lot involved in setting that up?
It isn't actually too bad to set it up. It's rather easy. It was, you know, I think it's so easy that I'm surprised not everyone's doing it, I guess I would say.
And really, most online stores are required to by law, and they don't. They don't know they're supposed to do it.
Exactly. I don't think people know. Because who's telling anybody? I think that's what's hard. But it's also such a new territory to, you know, how big and how much it's grown with online shopping. And, you know, you say pop-up shops new, but that was new 10 years ago. And I think, or, you know, still coming into its being 10 years ago. So
there are computers that enable those that are blind to utilize them.
Yeah, there are braille keyboards. There's
right,
all sorts
everything.
Of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder why. Yesterday at this conference, Fern Malice was talking about diversity and how far we've come. And then she went on to say how many groups of individuals are not yet being acknowledged. I mean, she didn't, but that would be one of them.
Me? I keep having to get the tailor to cut my pants off. Nobody makes
right.
pants
blind
in my
people
socks.
And Charles.
Me and the blind. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to
yeah,
us.
Yeah, this was great.
What's the website and what's your social media? How do people find you?
Yeah, thank you. The website is just the name of the business, www.seekcollective.com. The Instagram is the same, just Seek Collective, all one word. And those are sort of our big places you can find us.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Inspiring.
Thank
you
for having me.
Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast, a weekly look under the hood of the fashion business. And yes, the oil is leaking, and yes, it's possible we have no breaks. To get on the guest list for our live events, go to AmericanFashionPodcast.com and look for the live shows link. Please continue the conversation from the show on social media. On Twitter, we're at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we're at American Fashion Show. And I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. I meet people all the time who are so excited to hear about this show. A lot of people have heard about it, but not everybody, not enough people know this show exists, and we need your help to spread the word. Please do so. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, there's a Be a Guest form on the AmericanFashionPodcast.com website, but it helps if you've already started a discussion with us through social media. For direct comments, our voicemail line is 646-979-8709. Or email us info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and other episodes of the series, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.